Welcome to the PeaceWorks Podcast. I'm your host, Chris Moles. I'm a pastor and biblical counselor who helps churches and families confront the evil of domestic violence and promote healthy, God-honoring relationships.
Welcome back to the PeaceWorks Podcast, everyone. On today's episode, we're going to be talking about emotional abuse. But before we jump into that content, I want to take a moment to remind you about PeaceWorks Live. If you're not familiar with PeaceWorks Live, then I want to encourage you to take the time to do a little research on our annual conference. PeaceWorks Live is our annual event held here in West Virginia. And this year, October 10th and 11th, is set to be our biggest and best yet. PeaceWorks Live will be taking place in Winfield, West Virginia, and will feature many familiar names in our world. Jeremy Pierre, Greg Wilson from When Home Hurts, Darby Strickland from Is It Abuse, Joy Forrest from Called to Peace, Kirsten Christensen, and Beth Broom, part of the Caring for Families Caught in Domestic Abuse team, Sydney Millage of 37 Ways to Be Taken Captive, and our friend Melissa Affolter from Fieldstone, along with Ben Marshall from Freedom That Lasts and Adam Westlake, making up probably the largest, obviously the largest team we've ever had at PeaceWorks Live, but it will be, I think, our best event yet. So if you'd like to know more about attending PeaceWorks Live, you can find that information at our website, chrismoles.org. You're really going to want to check that out. This is the Domestic Abuse Intervention Conference from a biblical counseling perspective. All right, friends, let's jump into our content today. We're talking a little bit about emotional abuse. And we've been getting several questions or related questions from different places regarding kind of the nature of emotional abuse, how we view it, how we interpret it. And it really boils down to what is this category? And I know we've talked about this in the past, but I think I want to shift directions just a little bit so that we understand the not the complexities of the problem, but I guess, first of all, how we understand the problem and then how we patiently learn about the problem. And so this may help, it may not. And I know what I'm about to say is very different, but it kind of reminded me or came to my attention as I was thinking about this topic. And it has to do with hot dogs, which I know is weird, but bear with me. You probably know, maybe you don't know, but if you've traveled much around the United States, you know that hot dogs are a regional food. And so if you order a hot dog with everything in New York, it's going to be quite different than if you order a hot dog with everything in Chicago or on the West Coast or certainly in Cincinnati. And that is true as well here where I live, as if you were to come to my neck of the woods and order a hot dog with everything, it would come with mustard, onions, chili that we call sauce, hot dog sauce, and coleslaw on top of that. And so that's kind of the hot dog with everything around here. And I bring that up because I heard a story, and most West Virginians have a similar story, but I heard a story of a school. They were participating in an event in another state. Several schools from our region were traveling to an event. And the first year they were at that event, the concession stand was kind of confused when the folks from my neck of the woods were asking for coleslaw for their hot dogs. And it, of course, was met with a little bit of cynicism and criticism and a little bit of mockery, which is not, you know, uncommon. But eventually, someone realized that there was enough demand to investigate. And the following year, and every year subsequently, as this event takes place every year in another state, the following year they had a sign that said, "Yes, West Virginia, we have coleslaw." That simple act of investigating and serving really built a level of commonality and community with those folks. It introduced a new way to consume a food to a whole area. And it all began when somebody was willing to learn rather than to scoff. Now, I know hot dogs are not what we're talking about, but I do think that sometimes our conversations about emotional abuse can really be limited when we only see the problem as a matter of perspective, right? Similar to if I had said, well, that's dumb. Why would you consume hot dogs that way? Sometimes we view disclosures in the church of emotional abuse as that doesn't make sense. That can't be right. That's completely subjective. Your perspective is all we're talking about, as opposed to learning, listening, understanding why, and perceiving exactly what we're talking about and adding layers upon the conversation. And I know my analogy breaks down because one is a matter of taste and subjectivity to a degree. Yes, informed by culture. Yes, informed by where you're from. Yes, informed by familial preferences. And the other is a lived experience. But we have seen, and many of our questions are revolving around, the church's willingness to dismiss a lived experience with little investigation, little learning, and little compassion. And so that's really what I want to address today, that emotional abuse, yes, is a category that we use to help us understand the ways in which an individual is affected by coercively controlling behavior. And the categories really are not necessarily meant to be standalone categories. They're really meant to help us understand the concepts that we're talking about. And so when we're talking about emotional abuse, we're still talking about power used to control another person. We're still talking about coercion. We're not merely talking about perception. We're not merely talking about effects, although those do often start the conversation. So a couple things to know. Emotional abuse is not really about isolated incidents. Typically, when we're discussing aspects of abuse, when it comes to this category of how someone is affected emotionally or spiritually or mentally even, we're not talking about a single incident. We're talking about a pattern of events. Usually this occurs over time. It's usually well-established, and it is accompanied, as all abuse, with aspects of power and intent to control. So mistreatment is still the object of our concern, but we usually come to the point of recognizing it as mistreatment as we listen to the story of how that behavior affected someone else. It doesn't determine everything. It doesn't tell us exactly what we're dealing with all the time, but it is important to begin our conversation with that lived experience so that we can pull the rope, ask good questions, and learn more about the pattern. People who suffer under the weight of what we often call tactics of emotional abuse experience consequences, and they're real. Things like confusion, fear, low confidence or self-worth, constant questioning of oneself, difficulty concentrating, sometimes nightmares, sometimes anxiety, often anxiety, that is accompanied by things like insomnia, withdrawal from activities, and then sometimes even physical problems associated with the pressure that we're experiencing, whether it be digestive problems or heart or blood pressure issues or even aches and pains. There's also some research out there that indicate that some aspects of autoimmune disorders can be connected back to trauma. And please understand that what we categorize sometimes as emotional abuse, as we'll see in a moment as we discuss the tactics, can cultivate and create aspects of trauma, fear, and threat that can accompany physical illness. So when we're talking about emotional abuse, yes, the subjectivity, as it were, or the perception of the individual experiencing the mistreatment informs our questions, helps us understand, but we again are honing in and looking for the aspects of mistreatment. And that requires concern, listening, care, compassion, not simply dismissing someone because we don't see the world the way they see the world. We don't see what the point of coleslaw until we've tried it, right? So there is an aspect in which we have to live in community and learn from one another, in particular those who are experiencing harm. Think through some of the things that are common among this discussion of emotional abuse. Let's go to the tactics. And so this is actually my heartbeat, the heartbeat of our work, is that we listen to victims well, we listen to stories well. We're not investigating so much as we are learning about their experiences, and we're pinpointing and understanding and hearing and constructing these lists of tactics consistent with coercive control. Things such as controlling a person's behavior. Well, Chris, you can't do that emotionally. I beg to differ. I think you can control an individual emotionally, dictating who they spend time with, how they spend money. And there are overlaps to aspects of these categories of abuse. Because remember, we're talking about abuse. Emotional abuse is just one of the ways we try to understand how it's affecting people. But it is coercive control. Suspicion, guilt tripping, jealousy, all of these things can be tactics used to impress upon a victim the emotional need to conform. There's usually a consequence. Threatening someone's safety, as far as how they interact with the world, threatening their own safety, threatening their property, threatening a loved one's safety. Now, you may hear that and say, well, isn't that illegal? And in some states, yes, that could qualify as the code, but most of the time you're not going to receive a criminal charge for a subtle threat or a series of subtle threats that are reinforced culturally, reinforced familially or relationally through just everyday life. And that's really the subtle wickedness of these tactics, is that these threats can be perpetuated over and over and over and never cross the legal line of assault. And it puts a great deal of pressure on the person experiencing it. And we would certainly say threats of harm, threats toward well-being, threats of leaving an individual high and dry. Those are all aspects that we could biblically address once we know the tactics that are at play. Demeaning, shaming, publicly humiliating, these are some of the tactics that we have seen over the years individuals use. They can be observed. They can be recorded. They can be engaged with. They can be biblically quantified or qualified so that we actually have something to address. It's not merely the experience of the victim. Now it is the tactics in which are being used against them. Accusations, paranoia, sometimes associated with mental illness, oftentimes in abuse, not. Simply tactics used to control. Now again, in isolation, it may seem that one incident doesn't fit the pattern, doesn't help us recognize it, but multiple instances, multiple tactics across the board help us understand that there's an individual using position and power and authority to coercively control their partner. Constant criticism as a means of control can be part of this. Things like teasing or ridicule that are not fun but are part of that constant criticism, that directional work of an abusive person, where I'm using ridicule, mockery to keep someone in their place. We have seen this in the political realm as of late. We see this in the media. We see this in social media quite a bit, where ridicule is used in a threatening or coercive way. Now imagine that person's your intimate partner. That's some of the things that we're looking for. Looking for conditional care, conditional responses. So I will only do this if you do this. And so there becomes this bargaining that again is associated with threat or accompanied by power. Keeping someone awake, not allowing someone to function in a level of freedom or agency in which they choose. That's not harmful. It's not sinful. It's just you will conform to my wishes. Undermining a person's personal goals or achievements, making life about you as a partner can all be indications of that abuse. Now, some may look and say, well, Chris, that's still greatly subjective. And I can see that if we're only kind of looking at the surface. But with each tactic that we uncover, it requires more questions, more conversation. How were you threatened? In what ways were you threatened? What language was used to humiliate you? What was the scenario? Has this ever happened before? When was the first time? When was the last time? When was the most significant time to you? When you say that he refuses or doesn't allow you to spend time with people, what does that look like? How does he manage that? How does that happen? How has that happened most recently? What was the most significant time that took place? And often what you find as you just drill down and begin to ask more questions is that this category kind of shifts from the ethereal kind of, is this abuse, is this not abuse, to other categories outside of the emotional abuse category, to things like restraint, sexual coercion, even physical violence, use of the finances, use of the children, isolation, intimidation. Other tactics begin to creep in as an individual becomes more and more desperate for control. Sometimes emotional abuse doesn't involve the biggies, doesn't involve the threat, doesn't involve threats of violence. But as it occurs more and more and more in a relationship, it has an effect. And if an individual has addressed the ways in which this is affecting them and the abusive partner doubles down, attacks instead of reevaluates, continues to apply pressure to the victim or escalates, then certainly, however we want to label it, it's a problem that should be addressed. And it's not something that we can merely say, well, that's your experience, as opposed to saying, no, now we see the ways in which this mistreatment has unfolded in your life and how your partner has used these acts to harm you. So there's a lot more that we could talk about. I am, you know, as a pastor, as a counselor, you know, less likely to use that term, emotional abuse, with an individual. I'm usually more about collecting data, learning, because I do see so many of these categories as interconnected. But it does help us in our discussions, especially theoretically, talk about aspects of abuse so that we understand abuse more effectively, categorically, than just physical and sexual violence. But we begin to understand it in a larger framework that involves, yes, not just the experience of the victim, right, but the behaviors and tactics consistent with abusive people. All right, I hope that was helpful, guys. We are going to talk more about this in future episodes, so stay tuned. My hope is to unpack this a little bit more, especially in the area of the church. Once again, thank you guys for being part of the Peaceworks podcast. Your support means the world to us. It absolutely keeps us going. And so if you are enjoying what you're hearing on the Peaceworks podcast, please like, rate, review, follow, subscribe, whatever the platform you're listening on asks you to do. It lets them know how much you value the work we do here at Peaceworks. Again, thank you for being part of the Peaceworks podcast. We appreciate you all. Until next time, God bless.